Before we begin, before we get deep into the weeds, before we get into the podcast.
Yeah.
It's that time of the year again. It is Patreon time. You know, there are some benighted, fantastic people out there, John, who actually pay us for this gig.
I know, and I'm genuinely, eternally grateful to them.
But you know why they pay us? Not only do you get ad-free, lots of people don't like the ads.
Yeah.
But more importantly, you get to ask me questions every week. You get my Trinity courses. You get the audio of the Trinity courses. You get the visual of the Trinity courses. You get the book list of the Trinity courses.
The notes.
You get the notes. You get the books. You get the whole shebang. So if you want a really proper, deeply, as they say, immersive experience in the Dave McWilliams podcast, sign up now in December for your annual membership on Patreon. You'll get a 15% discount if you sign up before the 1st of January. So you know what? You know those people who listen to this show and you think, what will I get them for a present?
There you go.
Get Dave McWilliams for a present.
Dave McWilliams on a plate.
On a plate. So it is patreon.com/David McWilliams. Happy Christmas.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by ACAST.
Dobro dan, dobro večer, dobro gospodine, naše prijatelji. We are now, the IRC, or at least the David McWilliams podcast, postravaju divne ekipa Hrvatska. That means we are now supporting the wonderful Croatian team.
We sure are.
Yeah. So, moje prijatelj, slušamo, pričamo Hrvatski. Ajde, Hrvatski.
Come on, the nine legs.
Exactly. The devet nogu. The devet nogu. So, we are now definitely, as listeners of the podcast, you'll know that I have a great affinity for and an affection for Croatia. And it's just wonderful to see.
It is.
It just lifts the nation. It lifts a small nation
when
they're doing well. And their history for the last 20 years has not been great after the war in Yugoslavia. So many awful things happened. And the society, the country's still find it hard to get on their feet. Do you know they had a number one hit in the Croatian charts 2 summers ago? A song dedicated to Ryanair.
Really?
Because so many Croats live here.
Right.
We have given out 42,000.
It was a good track.
It was not a particularly good track. It was a Croatian rap track. Slightly sort of turbo.
Slagging it off, I hope.
Slightly turbo folky. No, they loved Ryanair. Because Ryanair was they're in the departure lounge going to Ireland. Ireland was the promised land for them. We've given out 42,000 PPI numbers to Croats in the last 2 years.
Wow.
Which is a huge amount. There's thousands of Croats here. Mm. They're in the registered fellas. What about the other fellas who aren't registered? So we're going to support Moje srce je Hrvatske.
Come on.
Okay, Hrvatski. Anyway, but today we're talking about a very serious thing. Okay, we're going to talk about the history. Remember we talked about frauds with Dan Davis?
Yes. Right? Yeah, which is fascinating.
Same sort of theme, because what's emerging now, the economies are now moving towards recession.
Mm.
The credit cycle of the last 10 years has come to an end. But more interestingly, as I've talked about before, the 40-year cycle of lots of credit, financial markets doing well, bond markets doing well, owners of capital doing well. It's all apparently, or not apparently, it seems to me to be coming to a close and we're on to a new phase. Now, there is a legend in Wall Street, a guy called Jim Chanos.
Yeah.
And he is not only a legend in terms of his presence in Wall Street, but in what he's done. he is the short seller. He's the guy who goes and says, you know, you hear all those great stories about this company or this country. I'm not sure that's the case, right? And I have watched him for years and years. I've read him. He teaches at Yale when he's not operating. You know, he's the difference between lots of people. You know, lots of people say, oh, that's going down.
Yeah.
Or that market's overvalued. He's the guy who bets against it. So just to give you a sense, John, right? Remember Enron?
Yes. Yeah.
He's the guy who shorted Enron.
Wow.
When everybody was saying Enron was the best thing since sliced bread, yeah. He said, no. He went in, he went into the company, he went into the accounts, and he said, no, this is a fraud. And he shorted it. This week in Germany, there's a massive, massive fraud case. Wirecard, you've heard of them?
Mm.
He shorted them. Luckin Coffee shorted them. These are all companies that have gone bust.
Right.
The Hertz Corporation shorted them. So, you know, Beyond Meat, a couple of years ago, everyone was talking about how we're all going to change.
That's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Shorted them. He just said, I'm calling BS on this.
Wow. Okay.
Right? So he's right. The guy who actually has the balls to actually put money behind his bets.
And he's what is he? He's like he researches and analyzes.
He identifies.
Yeah.
Right? He calls bullshit. And he says, okay, you all think that this is going this way. It's too good to be true.
Yeah. Right?
And he's been doing this successfully since the 1980s, 1990s. So a long, long, long time. And I'm a bit of a fanboy.
This guy must have incredible insights.
Yeah, extraordinary insights. So why don't we open up the podcast to the insights of Jim Chanos and let's go to New York. Now, over many, many years, I have been, as you all know, listeners, you know, obsessed with cycles, the economy, the way it works, the intersection of credit cycles and investment cycles, and when money is deluged into economy, what actually happens, probably because here in Ireland, we went through a bizarre credit boom-bust cycle in the last 10 or 15 years. And frankly, we're going through something broadly similar. Maybe not in the same magnitude, maybe not the same assets, but the same global effervescence is going on. And there's one man who has played the game of shorting the markets, a legend in Wall Street, of shorting markets, of identifying times when, you know what, maybe it's better not to go with the herd, to go against the herd, to short the herd. He is in the business, a man whose name is revered. I've just now heard off camera that he's a very good mate of Jim Sheridan's. He of The Name of the Father and all sorts of other movies. We'll talk about that in a second. But Jim Chanos, it is great to have you on the show. How are you?
I'm so thrilled to be here. I'm also a big fan. So it's the mutual beneficial society. I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you.
That's great, Jim. Now, Jim, I'm going to get straight into it, okay? Because lots of people will have heard of, lots of listeners who've been following economics but might not have worked in markets will have heard of short selling. They kind of have a fairly good idea what it is. Tell us, before we talk about where we are in the cycle, what you think of the macro world, what exactly does a short seller do? What do they see and how do they act on it?
So let me begin, David, by just simplifying a little bit and saying that all kinds of businesses engage in short selling every day. And short selling is simply taking in money up front for goods and services to be performed later, ideally at a profit. So, for example, an airline that sells you an advance purchase ticket is short selling you a seat. Farmers who sell forward their crops for next year's harvest are short selling those. They like today's price. They're willing to deliver it a year from now at an attractive price. Yeah. That's a short sale. Probably the biggest short sale scheme in all of finance and business is insurance. Insurance companies take in premiums upfront to pay out in various different occurrences in the future and then earn interest or income on that money while they wait. So in the securities markets, short selling is essential for efficient markets, if you go back to any of the academic theories behind markets, and that is that uninterested people should be able to also set prices. So from an economist's point of view, that's the way to think about it. So just because I don't own that car, if I could short sell the car at a very crazy price and deliver it a year from now at a lower price, I should be able to do that. You can't do that in all markets. You can do it in the securities markets.
Right.
So okay. In a short sale, I borrow the shares from a broker.
Yep.
And with the promise to pay those shares back in some unspecified time in the future. I sell them at 10x.
Yep.
And hopefully in the future, buy back those shares at 5x.
And make the difference.
And then return the borrow, the shares, and lock in a profit. Of course, the opposite can happen. And the share price can keep going up. And because share prices can go up infinitely, you can certainly lose a lot more money on a short sale than you can make, theoretically.
Yeah.
Although, as I've often said, I've seen a lot more stocks go to zero than infinity. So there is that.
Now, listen, let's how did you get into this business? How did you get into business? Because it is a niche part, even though you say, and you're right, that in all markets, there's all sorts of ways of if you think a price is going down, and it'll go down in the future, there's all sorts of ways of mitigating that risk. Okay, but in terms of your own game in the finance game, how did you decide, okay, that's where I'm going to get into? You know, I've done the normal broking earlier on, I worked in a bank, but actually this interests me.
Well, my adult children would say I was dropped on my head at birth, but I think it was probably a little bit more serendipitous than that. I was an analyst. I started out in investment banking. I went over into the brokerage business, and I was a young analyst in Chicago in 1982, and I was asked to take a look at a very aggressive, high-flying insurance company in the United States called Baldwin United. It was the old Baldwin Piano Company, and it had morphed into selling annuities and mortgage insurance and a variety of other things. And it was the fastest growing financial service company in the United States at that time. And it was an accounting fraud. And I started looking into it and started digging into it. And I put out a couple of research reports in the second half of 1982 telling people they should sell the stock or, if they were aggressive, short the stock because of the things we had uncovered. And the company filed for bankruptcy in 1983. It was the largest financial bankruptcy in the U.S. up until that point. And I had no predisposition to be a short side research analyst, but our clients at this small firm said, okay, well, what else doesn't the kid like?
Fantastic.
And at that point, the light bulb went on and I said, well, maybe I could carve out a niche doing this, you know, deep institutional research to the downside, looking for things that are flawed, as opposed to the 10,000, you know, analysts all looking for things to buy. And so I did that for a few years at Deutsche Bank. I was hired away and moved to New York. And in 1985, the front page of the Wall Street Journal had a story about this evil group of short sellers who were destroying these fine American companies. And inside the Wall Street Journal was basically one of those drawings of a kid throwing a pebble into a pond with the rings. And the outer ring was institutional investors. And then the next ring in was hedge funds. And the next thing ring in was traders. And then the final little entry point was short sellers, and I was the kid throwing the pebble in. So my boss in Frankfurt didn't really like that, and I was called that morning and said my contract would not be renewed at the end of 85. So I called up one of my clients and told them the bad news, and they were thrilled. They said, that's great. And I said, I don't really see what's so great about losing my job. They said, we're going to put you in business. And so that's when I started my firm in the fall of 85. So it was a series of sort of serendipitous things that happened, and I was very lucky.
So to make you identify and your team identify and over the years have identified companies or countries or let's say companies, right? And then we go on to countries, but let's say companies that you think, hold on a second, this story is too good to be true. There's something under the bonnet here that doesn't quite make sense.
Yeah, so the ideal short sale, of course, is something that is not only overpriced, but may have aspects of fraud attached to it. And those are the ones that everybody remembers. And the companies like Wirecard and more famously for us, Enron. And there, of course, you know, the size of the frauds are massive in the tens of billions of dollars. But, you know, there are broader aspects of things we've looked at down through the years, like the credit system before the global financial crisis, the Chinese real estate market in the last 10 years, that are sort of more in your bailiwick of big macro themes that are, you know, that are disconcerting.
And now tell me, so what we do know is that we've had a massive, massive credit expansion since 08 and then since the pandemic. So 08 and then all the way through to, let's say, 2019, then we get another panic. So these events always emerge at the end of a credit cycle. Where Yes. do you think we are now? What do you think all these frauds, all these companies that are falling to work, what are they telling us about the world?
Yeah. So I teach, as I think you know, a course on the history of financial market fraud. And one of the overarching themes, David, is that the fraud cycle follows the financial cycle and business cycle with a lag. So the longer the business and financial cycle goes on, the more people's sense of disbelief is eroded. They begin to believe things are too good to be true at the end. You have fear of missing out, all the things you know. And so it becomes easier to basically get money from investors for all kinds of things that may or may not be true. And we're certainly starting to see the evidence now of that in this cycle. It always starts with a few instances like the Theranoses and the Valiant Pharmaceuticals in the US. And then we saw Wirecard in 2020. But now, of course, with the advent of crypto and the frauds we're seeing, you know, almost weekly, you know, surface there. And I suspect it's going to get worse. I mean, I think we're going to see just this cycle in particular. I've called it the golden age of fraud. You know, not only are we seeing just excesses in Silicon Valley, but we're seeing excesses in accounting across corporate America, very similar to what we saw in the dot-com era. And I think that that's not going to end well for lots of reasons. And again, the longer the cycle and the more the credit impulse, as you've indicated, the worse the resulting revelations tend to be.
Now, I heard you say that, for example, you're short a company like Tesla, you know, which was the darling of the world. And, you know, there was an all sorts of, this is going to change the way battery technology, change the way cars are made, et cetera, et cetera. And you said, well, maybe not.
Well, I mean, it's that story. There's plenty of things that I could point to at Tesla that where statements have made that appear, shall we say, to be more than a bit of a stretch of the truth. But the simpler story at Tesla is it's a car company. And as much as Elon Musk will tell you it's not, but it's something much greater, robotics or robo-taxis or whatever, it's a car company. It's a very profitable car company, but it's a car company that sells very expensive cars and in particular sells very expensive cars in China, which is where it makes all its money. And I don't think people appreciate the China risk that this company has. And just to put it in perspective, I think you know this, but Tesla for the last few years now has had a market value equal to all the other publicly traded car companies combined.
Yeah.
And of course, it sells just a fraction of those cars that the rest do combine. So every bull market has a hopes and dreams kind of stock where people project onto a real business things that it can never do. And it was Cisco back in among others, back in the dot-com era, for example. And Cisco was a fine company. It made routers. It was profitable. But by the end, when the stock went parabolic in 2000, people thought it was going to produce all the hardware for the internet. And the same thing with Tesla. It's the hopes and dreams retail stock of this bull market. And it will survive. It will produce cars. But it is not worth $500 billion, or wherever it is right now, $600 billion.
Or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And tell me, I want to talk to you about China risk, because I found your analysis of the Chinese, well, just the intersection of where Chinese politics, the Chinese banking system, the Chinese credit cycle, and of course, most evident, the Chinese housing boom bust cycle, which is now materially obvious to people. Tell me how you think this plays out. Or materially obvious to some people. Tell me how it all plays out. And why did you think, hold on a second, and this was a couple of years ago, you said, wait a sec, this doesn't stack up.
Yeah, it was a lot more controversial when we started calling it out back in 2010. People thought we were crazy. And look, it is an economic model that is just fraught with danger. But it's so interesting from an economics point of view because, as you know, it's a closed system. And so it really is this really unique laboratory is how long can a developed and increasingly large economy depend on investment for almost 50% of GDP. I mean, it's unprecedented,
right?
We saw the Asian tigers in the mid-90s combined had investment, you know, in the mid-30s, 34, 35% for 4 or 5 years, and that collapsed. And of course, Japan in the late 80s got up to around 30% for a number of years, and that collapsed. Well, China's been at 43 to 48% for better part of 15 years. And
and the amount of money, when you see those sort of headline figures, the amount of money that's been wasted, been misallocated, been even fraudulently absorbed into the system. But it's just like that is a massive, massive red flag.
Well, it's interesting because, of course, the idea always was, well, it was going to transition into a consumption society. However, you can't repress consumption as the Chinese have to do, because even way back in my macroeconomic class, I remember that S equals I, right?
Yeah.
Saving has to equal investment. And so the Chinese people have to save to pay for all of, to put the bank deposits so that the banks can lend money for all this investment. And as long as you never write anything off and you pretend this fiction that the banking system is solvent, you're fooling yourself on GDP. Yeah, I joke that China's the only advanced economy that knows its annual GDP on January 1st of that year. Because, you know, they're going to plan enough investment to make the numbers. And the model, really, it's the accounting tail wagging the economic dog. Because until perhaps recently, they were so obsessed with GDP that they would do anything to hit those numbers, no matter how uneconomic at the end of the day in terms of real wealth it was.
No, I remember that. It was like 7% or bust at all costs. You know. But actually, so for example, many, many listeners will have experienced a very, very mini but traumatic version of that in Ireland, which is it was a nexus of government getting lots and lots of easy tax money from a building boom that was going through the roof. The banking system was growing at ridiculous, on what should be a very basic business. You're lending money, okay? So it should be a very basic growth rate. It was getting, you know, all its accolades, all its chief executives were appearing at Davos talking about climate change, all that sort of malarkey, okay?
And you think, well, David, I can tell you a personal story some of your Irish listeners may or may not appreciate. But I was taking my daughter through Ireland, through Dublin, and then the UK to visit universities. She ended up at University of Edinburgh. I wanted her to go to Trinity. But when we landed in Dublin, we had a lovely gentleman pick us up at the airport, take us to our hotel. And, you know, there were construction everywhere. This was 2006, I believe.
Oh, right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It was the height of the tiger.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, but, you know, I've heard about all this construction activity. He said, oh, it's amazing. He goes, I own four buildings myself. And I mean, it's very rare those kind of anecdotes hit you over the head.
But that's
a true story. My driver owned four buildings. This was 05, 06.
Yeah. No, that was true. So can you imagine now how many of those stories are being told in China or were being told in China or still maybe being told in parts of China up to this day?
Well, most apartments now that are flat, you know, the thing about China is, of course, is an awful lot of the flats are empty, but they're owned. They were sold.
Yes.
They were sold as investments. And so it's although they may be vacant, the deed transferred. And many families own two or three flats. And so it is seen as a store of wealth. And again, it's a very real estate centric economy, which is ironic because this all really happened when people could actually own leaseholds in 1998 or 99. So there isn't a long history of property ownership, of course, in the People's Republic of China.
No, absolutely not. I mean, you know, if you think the owning property was illegal up until the last generation.
And you still can't own the land. The state owns all the land.
Yeah, but you own the property. I mean, how does it end? You know, I mean, we've seen how it ends in Ireland. It ends with a massive internal default, sometimes an external default. The government might decide not to default externally. So in effect, it allows the people to default on themselves. And how do you think it ends in China?
As long as the banking system can keep all the plates spinning in the air, it will hold up. I mean, so that's why they're so terrified of bank runs. And, you know, because it all goes through, everything in China goes through the bank, commercial banking system. And that's an important thing to understand. Even when companies issue bonds, for example, most of the buyers are commercial banks.
Right.
So we keep a close eye on the commercial banking system. And for years now, it has grown faster than nominal GDP. Assets have grown faster than nominal GDP because basically it's Ponzi finance, right? They're lending on new projects, but they're also lending on old projects so you can pay their interest back. And that cannot last. I mean, so I'll give you a very good set of numbers that will bring this home. So when China had its last banking crisis, before it entered the WTO in 2000 and 2001, most of the bad loans in the banking system were to state-owned enterprise, you know, big conglomerate businesses. And the Chinese economy was roughly $1 trillion U.S. GDP. And the Chinese banking system had $1 trillion in loans, of which $400 billion were bad. And they it took them quite a while to restructure that. They had to write some off over time. They did these asset management companies who are sort of state-backed to issue debt to buy the debt from the banks. And there was a lot of stuff that kind of had to be worked out over time. Well, fast forward to today, the Chinese economy is about $14 trillion U.S.
Yep.
And the banking system is pushing $60 trillion.
Okay. So basically China, so China, you know, used to be a country with a banking system. It's now a system with a country stuck onto it.
Yeah. It's massive. And the real estate economy dwarfs everything. It's anywhere but 20 to 30% of GDP is residential real estate construction and activity, relative services, whatever. And you know, that's multiples of any other advanced economy. And that's just residential. That's before the infrastructure investment and the commercial investment. So this, I always joke, China's just one big construction site. And it's really quite true.
And of course, it's one big construction site that now has a dear leader who's got in for a third unelected term. But what you're saying, though, so is that internally, unless the Chinese continue to bail out their banking system, which they may well do by taking resources from elsewhere, this is a country that just goes bust.
Well, and one of there's one other little twist that's worth monitoring, and that is for years the Chinese have encouraged Western capital to come in, you know, to help in these process, right? But of course, in the last few years, that's become problematic because Western investors have been burned by the VIE structure that China uses to get Western capital. And I don't want to get too much in the weeds right now, but basically, if you are a Western investor in stocks or bonds in Chinese entities, you don't own the underlying assets. You don't have a claim on the assets inside the People's Republic. You have shares or debt on a British Virgin Island or Cayman Island.
Yeah, some shell special company. Vehicle, which is
right.
Yeah.
And your asset is a contract sitting in a safe that says you will share in the economics in some unspecified way in a proportion pursuant to this agreement. And so it was wonderful. The only problem is the Chinese courts do not recognize the VIE structure. So it was the best of all worlds for the Chinese. They told Western investors, come on in, buy our stocks and bonds, but you don't really have any claim on anything inside our borders. And
wow.
That is a really amazing development that doesn't get enough press as it should. But Western creditors now in a bunch of the real estate developers who are struggling, they're finding out that their bonds are trading at 5 cents on the dollar, 3 cents on the dollar, because they have no claim on the real estate inside the People's Republic. And so it's an amazing story, really, at how the Chinese worked that and worked Western investors into providing marginal capital for them.
But it's also the story, we come back to the dream idea of the moment. So the dream idea, we talked about Tesla being the dream idea of a certain sector. China was also this dream idea in the same way that Japan was in the 1980s, in the same way that arguably, in the small case of Ireland, Anglo-Irish Bank was or whatever, there was this sense that, you know, we had reinvented the wheel. And I want to come back because to your Yale course, which I was reading last night, it's a course I would absolutely love because as listeners in the podcast know, my major obsession is economic history, is stuff that happened in the past. I love the South Sea Bubble. I love Talleyrand. I love John Law. I love the railway, you know, boom busts. You know, as I've always said, there was a railway boom bust in Ireland. The amazing thing about Ireland was during the famine, when the western half of the country was starving, the eastern part of the country, a part of the eastern part of the country around here in Dublin, was actually involved in a speculative mania on railway shares. So it's amazing, you know, we never think about this. But let's just talk about just the big historical sweep of the stuff that you are interested in and where it all sits, because what we're talking about is human behavior, really.
Yeah. And so, well, there's a few themes in the class. We mentioned one already. Another one is that the truly devastating frauds are the state-sponsored financial frauds. So we start the class basically with John Law in France.
Yeah, I have it here. I have it here. Okay.
So, and the South Sea Bubble, which amazingly took place only 9 months later in London. after the London finance world had laughed about the French and said about how silly the French were to believe this guy Law. And then they went and did the same thing themselves in London less than a year later. But those were based on monopoly concessions with the new world, and it was the ultimate big picture story, right?
Yeah.
What was greater than doing trade with these two continents that you had just discovered, right? That you were going to pull gold and silver out and tobacco and so it captivated, you know, two great powers, the French and the English. One of the interesting things was how the aftermath was treated. The French turned their back on capitalism after it happened and kind of shrugged their shoulders and said, what are you going to do? Everybody's a crook. We should have known better. And went back to their same money printing ways, which actually brought them to ruin 70 years later. The English, interestingly, went the other way. They actually threw a lot of the promoters into the Tower, took all their money, prosecuted the boards of directors, and cut back on speculative stock trading, but said, okay, we got to learn our lesson and change the rules, but still understand that capitalism is important. And of course, that was the right decision. We saw it with the railroads in the UK, and I'm finding out now in Ireland in the 1830s and 1840s, the US in the 1870s. There it was the Credit Mobile Yay scandal, which was the Enron of the 19th century. That was state-sponsored. That was the US government building the Transcontinental Railroad and being defrauded by the Union Pacific Railway execs. So it depends. And the really interesting thing is what happens after these waves. You know, after the 1920s, we had a really strict change, particularly in the States. We had the SEC come in. We had new laws. We really tightened things up, the banking system, Glass-Steagall. But after the global financial crisis, we didn't do much of anything. And so it's interesting. We were much more aggressive after the banking crisis of the 80s, the S&L crisis. 3,000 bankers went to jail. And the dot-com era, which brought us Enron and Tyco and WorldCom, where lots of people went to jail and we changed the accounting rules. But after the global financial crisis, everybody looked and said, well, I guess I lied on my mortgage application too. We're all in on it. Let's just kind of forget about it.
But this is where I want to conclude. I want to finish this, Jim. So 08, there was, let's forget about it. Let's pump the system up again. Let's have a couple of show trials. But frankly, you know, let's just leave.
Although not in Iceland.
Not in Iceland. Exactly.
Interestingly. One of the more aggressive places. They actually went after people.
But they also, the Icelandics kind of outdid themselves. I remember going to see West Ham United, one of the great London clubs, at a time when they'd been bought by an Icelandic geezer who decided that there was, speaking of tall tales and yarns, that if he could tell the story that in some way he was the reincarnation of Leif Erikson, the Viking. Okay, I jest you not.
I know, the Icelandic bank guys were amazing.
They were amazing. So they came up with this yarn. So the great yarn in Ireland was, people don't understand it. Irish banking is called relationship banking. Now, if you break down relationship, it means your friends. It means your mates.
Yeah.
So basically, Irish banking is, we give our mates money, right? You look the other way. That's our business model. And say, they'd say, oh, all these people with their obsession with numbers, they don't understand that Irish banking is, it's almost like we see it in our heart. It's like when De Valera was asked about the Irish people, he says, I look into my heart and I see what the Irish people want, right? Same sort of stuff, right? The Icelandics, God bless them, came up with this Leif Erikson, the guy who discovered the United States, the Norseman, right? And they said that deep in our DNA is a pioneering Vikings sort of pushing the boundaries. We were always traders. We were always the people.
Oh,
we traded with Constantinople and Greenland, and we used to trade in ivory and tusks of walruses and all that stuff.
So I'm
sitting in West Ham making a documentary about this, talking to the dude, thinking to myself, this is, it's television gold, but it's bonkers stuff. And of course, what he wanted was, his obsession was, to get an Icelandic center forward playing for West Ham. That was the business strategy.
Well, as we know, fortune favors the brave, David.
Oh!
By the way, I remember getting a friend of mine showing me a brochure for a new development in Constanța, Romania in 06 on the Black Sea, not far from Istanbul, Constantinople.
Yeah.
And the two lenders, one was, I think, Allied Irish, and the other was one of the big Icelandic banks. They had a beachside resort in Romania.
Oh, listen, yep. We can go on all night about Romania and Bulgaria. But yeah, when guys who are brought up in Fermoy and Tralee are out in Constanza on the Black Sea with an encyclopedic knowledge of the real estate market there and lending not to Romanians, but to other people from Tralee and Fermoy, right?
Yeah. Oh, this was being marketed in elsewhere in the EU, yeah.
Oh, yeah, no, it was marketed in Ireland. It was marketed in Ireland.
I'm sure it was, yeah.
But let's conclude, Jim, because I love all this stuff, right? Maybe this time it's different. Maybe what we're witnessing now after the massive expansion since the pandemic, maybe, you know, the SPACs, the cryptos, the this, that, and the other, this world, that there may well come a moment where the government say, hold on a second, we're not going to react to this like 08. We're not going to look the other way and pump the system again. In actual fact, we might change our view of the form of capitalism, the form of finance that has emerged in the same way as they did in the 1930s.
Well, Wall Street better hope not, because that response in which we got further into the idea of political economy, that response, which might say, you know what, we are going to put some shackles on capital because it has just acted so badly in the last 25 years, and we're going to emphasize labor again. So I always tell the story that for two summers I worked while I was in university in a steel mill in my hometown of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I was making $14 an hour as a union employee in 1979.
Wow.
That was the peak of the U.S. labor force, was 1979 in terms of real wages. And, you know, the 70s, from 1966 to 82, the S&P and the Dow dropped almost 90% in real terms, and the bond market was destroyed. The real economy actually didn't do so badly. The nominal GDP and real GDP grew pretty nicely over that period. But almost everybody on Wall Street lost their jobs. And of course, that was part of a longer wave from 1929 to 1979, where basically you had much more government involvement. You had an emphasis on labor. You had an emphasis on real wages. You had an emphasis on unemployment. And Wall Street was an afterthought. And if Wall Street did okay, fine. But it was the financial markets were not the be-all and end-all of policy. That changed in 79 and 80 with the advent of Thatcher and Reagan, I think. And the pendulum, which had gone, you know, to the point where I was making $14 an hour at 20 years old in a steel mill, you know, began to move toward capital, and capital gains rates were cut. We needed to do interest rates, of course, declined dramatically. When I got on Wall Street in 1980, rates were 14%. And the S&P was trading at 7x earnings. And so that has done nothing but just go further for better part of 45 years now. And if something has changed, whether it's the advent of inflation for the first time in years, or just a sense of the public having enough or whatever you, that is something I tell my friends on Wall Street, you're not prepared for. Because if that pendulum goes the other way, it will go the other way, you know, probably for some meaningful period of time. Economic populism, if you will. And that won't treat financial markets well. The overall economy might do just fine. But the financial economy, which has boomed to multiples of the real economy, you know, in our lifetimes, you know, might have rougher weather.
Because, Jim, this is exactly where I want to take this, because it seems to me that if you value your history, and if you value exploring and reading about those moments where public opinion shifts and villains emerge who were heroes not that long prior to the shift in public opinion, the legal system shifts, the feel of the society shifts. When I look at the United States, and I when the last time I was there was a couple of weeks ago, I was in New York, and you just get this feeling of a society on the edge, that something big, when I say something big, in the political economy could well materialize that would change decades of policy. And some part of me feels that, you know, watching these crypto bros, these tech bros, that edifice, which was really the sort of the glittering prize of the end of a credit boom, watching those guys not just have feet of play, but possibly have criminal charges against them.
Oh, maybe. Very much. And criminality changes things. I mean, it changed things slightly after the Enron occurrence. And again, when it's criminality that is obvious and more focused, the GFC was interesting because, again, if you remember, the FBI put out its warning in 2005 in the U.S. that everybody was engaged in mortgage fraud, right? People were lying on their applications because they wanted to buy bigger houses.
Yeah.
Don't worry,
we did that thing here too. That
was exactly. It was global.
So
that had a lot to do with the outrage being diffused, but despite a fair amount of wrongdoing in the banks themselves and the accounting in the banks. But if you get a 1929 or a 19post.com type thing where you begin to, the public gets to be kind of outraged by what they see, then you get political change, right? And then you get the central banks beginning to worry politically as well. And it's fascinating. One other aspect to this that is worth watching and post-pandemic, and that is the austerity that a lot of Western governments had in the last 40 years, relatively, went out the window post-COVID, right? So we saw $5 trillion in stimulus directly to the U.S. economy, $1.8 trillion to households in 2020 and 2021. That is $15,000 per household, the basic checks that went out. And it's going to be interesting come the next real recession, what the impetus will be from the public. Because if you sent me a check for COVID, why aren't you sending me a check now? And were the floodgates open fiscally? And how will central banks react to that now that we see that that kind of thing can lead to higher prices? And what will be the political response? Because we now have opened that Pandora's box of just almost unlimited stimulus to the public in times of trouble. And that was not the case after the GFC.
No,
I mean, the stimulus, the GFC was very de minimis.
Well, actually, the GFC was the opposite in actual fact.
It said to the
local dudes who'd never actually involved themselves in the business of stocks and shares, actually, it's your fault. You guys take the flak. And what you're saying is the appetite for bigger government,
yeah,
in the next decade is there.
Particularly in the U.S., yeah.
Fascinating stuff.
You know, the blinkers may be off there. We'll see. But it's worth noting because it was those aggressive stimulus programs were passed bipartisan. And for all the political wrangling in the U.S. about with the Democrats and Republicans, remember that the biggest spending bills that have happened in U.S. history have happened on a overwhelming bipartisan basis.
That's because they see which way the wind is blowing. So, Jim, fantastic, wonderful stuff. And I hope to see you here in June.
I'm a big fan, so thank you so much for having me. Happy holidays, and I hope to see you in Ireland this summer.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
So, John, there you have Jim talking about China.
Amazing stuff. Right? That was incredible stuff.
Talking about looking at companies, finding companies that are frauds that everyone thinks are amazing. Basically saying, you know, Tesla, it's a car company. It makes cars. And it's like, you know, forget all that sort of stuff. And if it makes cars, lots of other people make cars. But fascinatingly at the end there, talking about how looking back at history, there are pivotal moments when the world changes. When you get these frauds, when you get the short sellers coming in, when you get the markets falling, when you get people reassessing the whole political economy. And he's saying after the global financial crisis in 2008, it was like, business as usual. But what Jim is saying just now, he's saying, maybe not. Maybe the next 5 years, the pendulum will swing completely politically as a result of criminal behavior, which will change public opinion. We're going to come back over the next couple of weeks.
Absolutely. We've got a lot to talk about there.
But we'll see you on Thursday. Take care. Well, it's that time of the year again. It is Patreon time. You know, there are some benighted, fantastic people out there, John, who actually pay us for this gig.
I know, and I'm genuinely, eternally grateful to.
But you know why they pay us? Not only do you get ad-free, lots of people don't like the ads.
Yeah.
But more importantly, you get to ask me questions every week. You get my Trinity courses. You get the audio of the Trinity courses. You get the visual of the Trinity courses. You get the booklet of the Trinity courses. The
notes.
You get the notes. You get the books. You get the whole shebang. So if you want a really proper, deeply, as they say, immersive experience in the Dave McWilliams podcast, sign up now in December for your annual membership on Patreon. You'll get a 15% discount if you sign up before the 1st of January. So, you know what? You know those people who listen to this show and you think, what'll I get them for a present?
There you go.
Get Dave McWilliams for a present.
Dave McWilliams on a plate.
On a plate. So it is patreon.com/David McWilliams. Happy Christmas.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.